nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
I guess, as you know, what we have been talking about is how we get this density of states and the density of modes from a theoretical model, from a simple atomistic model. And that's what we've been doing for the last month or so. And coming next week, we'll go on to the next part of things, that how to go beyond this, how to think about spin, energy conversion, and other kinds of devices and all that. That we'll get to next day. Now, today what I wanted to do was finish up on one thing that we didn't quite get a chance to talk about. And it's because there's one of those things that's very important but didn't quite fit into the flow of what I was telling you about. And so I want to finish up on that today. And that has to do with this EK relationship. Because if you remember, of course, back in September, we were talking about how, given a density of states, you find current, charge, etc. And this last month of October, we've been talking about how you get density of states from this atomistic model. And one intermediate step there is this EK relation, right? That you, starting from this atomistic model, you get an EK relation, and from that EK relation, you get a density of states. Now, usually then, the output from that EK relation that you need is like, well, how many valleys are there? And around each valley, what does EK look like? So a very common picture is something like this. E versus K looks like H bar square K square over 2M. That's a very common picture for the conduction band of many solids. But one important thing to remember is that that's not how it looks like for all K, really. If I actually looked at the picture of E versus K, it's a fairly complicated thing because this K is a three-dimensional vector, and you have an energy corresponding to every value of K. And if you draw it along some direction, it will look something like this, say, etc. And when you draw a picture like this and go on with it, you are really assuming that only thing that matters is this part of the EK relationship. And why is it that only that matters? Well, because your chemical potential happens to be somewhere here or around here. And when you put a little voltage, then the current flow is due to these things. Everything else more or less stays the same. So for current flow purposes, this is good enough. Now, if you are trying to find other properties of solid, like its mechanical strength or something else, then this isn't adequate. Then you really need to know a lot more about the energy, I mean, the total energy of the system, and that's a whole different thing that we're not even discussing. Right?
What do you mean mechanical strength?
Like, let's say, how stiff it is. So if I want to press it, you know, there's a stiffness coefficient. So if you're a mechanical engineer, that's the kind of thing you'd be interested in.
Well, you take a material and you press it.
Right, then how does it get a little, I mean, how much smaller does it get? Usually when you press it, it will get smaller, any solid. Question is, how much smaller does it get? If it's very stiff, then it won't change much. And certain materials are very stiff. Well, some materials are not so stiff. Right? And so those are properties that people are interested in. Then there are, in material science, you also worry, you could also ask questions like, why does silicon form a diamond lattice and not some other lattice, for example? And the generic answer is because the diamond lattice has the lowest energy. But that energy has nothing to do with these current flow levels that we are talking about. That energy is the total energy, right, which we discussed in some lecture at length. Okay. But the point is then that from all that band structure calculation, that EK relation that you get, finally the question you ask people is, well, how many valleys are there of interest, and what does EK look like around that valley? Because given that, you can then find the density of states, density of modes, whatever you like, and get on with the rest of it. But then the question is, what do you mean by values, how do you locate them? And I tried to give you some example from graphene. Yeah.
But for silicon, the lowest point of the E doesn't occur at the K, but just
right. Very good point. So actually, what happens is, in silicon, this picture in a particular direction in K would actually look more like this. So that the lowest point is around here. And so when we draw a picture like this and assume that it represents silicon, you're really glossing over quite a few issues. Namely, this isn't really around K equals 0, it's around this, for one. But you don't have to worry about it in a simple calculation, usually. And then the other issue is that actually you have 6 such valleys, not just one of them here. So number of valleys, so when you calculate, say, the electron density, if you take the density of states for one valley, you'll only get 1/6 of the actual number of electrons. So the person who is actually measuring this experimentally, he, of course, sees the result of all 6 valleys. So whatever electron density they are measuring experimentally, to get to match that, you'd have to take into account the fact that it's not just EK like this, but there's 6 of them. And there is one more subtlety that I didn't quite get into, which complicates the math a little bit. And that is that actually, instead of looking like this, where it's the same for all directions, you could have different masses for the X, Y, and Z directions. So this curve around here could actually have a different curvature along X than along Y, for example. So you could have a MX and a MY. And what that does is, mathematically, in the, you know, that delta function, I mean, the expressions are fine. It's just that when you try to evaluate that delta function, it gets a little more messy because you have to worry about this fact in there. So that's the part I kind of didn't get into. Okay. But what I want to tell you a little more about is just how do you locate these valleys and this concept of Brillouin zone that I had stressed, that I had kind of mentioned in the context of a 1D solid, but later on we didn't talk much about it. Okay. Now, if you remember, what we had discussed was something like this, that if you have a 1D solid where you have atoms or unit cells spaced by A, then when I draw this EK diagram, you might get, say, something like this, you know, or it could be going this way, one of the two. But the point is that when I count the number of states, firstly, they are equally spaced by 2 pi over L, where L is the length of the solid. But more importantly, the part we want to talk about today is that you don't have to consider all the states for all values of K. You can restrict your attention to what's called the first Brillouin zone, what goes from minus pi over A to plus pi over A, where A is the spacing. And the argument was that, you see, when I write the wave function at any lattice point n, it is given by psi 0 e to the power I k n a. K n a. Where n is the location, whichever point I'm talking about. And the thing is that if I add, if supposing someone has a solution for some value of k, and I come along with a new solution where I've added 2 pi over A to it, I'm really not writing a new solution. It's really the same old one. Because if I add here 2 pi over A, it makes no difference because this additional thing gives you a phase factor that is really a multiple of 2 pi, no matter what the value of n. I can look at any point on this lattice and use k or k plus 2 pi over a, and I'll calculate the same number. So even though you have given it a new name, it's really not a new solution. That's the point. And hence, I only need to look at solutions over a Brillouin zone. Now, it need not have been symmetric from minus pi over a to plus pi over a. I could have gone from 0 to 2 pi over a, for example. That's possible. But the point is, I only need this range. And what is common is to choose it symmetrically. That's what's usually done. You go symmetrically around 0 from minus pi over a to plus pi over a. And that's called the first Brillouin zone. And when classifying solutions then, I only need to consider those k's that lie here. And anything outside really is equivalent to something inside. Okay, that's the point. And what I want to do is, rest of the class is, discuss how this concept gets generalized in more complicated solids. I mean, 1D it's pretty clear. Actually, another one that's reasonably clear is this one. Is if you had a square lattice in two dimensions, say. So in other words, let's say it's not just 1D this way. I've got a two-dimensional thing like this, for example. And let's say the spacing in this direction is B. So the question is, what is the Brillouin zone for this? Because now it's a two-dimensional thing. So when I look at the EK relationship, I really have something in two components, kx and ky. Now the question is, what region of this k-plane should I be considering when writing down my solutions? You know, when it was 1D, it was clear. You just go from minus pi over a to plus pi over a. That was it. That was it. Question is, in a two-dimensional solid like this, what will it be? And actually, the answer is what you might have guessed intuitively. And that is, it's minus pi over a to plus pi over a this way. And it goes from minus pi over b to plus pi over b this way. So the region you really need to consider is this one. And what you can show is that any other point here is really equivalent to some point in here. Okay? So the final answer is kind of intuitive in this case. It gets a little harder when you consider something complicated like, say, the graphene lattice, you know, where it's hexagonal. And then it's not quite clear how to draw it, and you need to do it in a more mathematical, formal way to get the right answers. For something like this, you can, as I said, you can almost guess what it is. Yeah.
Graphene, we know that actually the EK diagram is not periodic. I mean, goes on. So can we actually define a Brillouin zone for something like graphene?
Using exactly the same argument. Actually, it will be periodic. Yeah. What I can show is, using exactly the same argument, that if you take a K in here, it will be equivalent to some other k out there. So you give me any point here, I'll find you an equivalent point here so that the wave functions you calculate will all be the same. Right. So that will go through. Okay. Now, the formal way people do this is the following. It goes like this. That given a real space lattice like this, what you first construct is something that you call the reciprocal lattice. And the reciprocal lattice looks like this. So those big X's, those are the points on the reciprocal lattice. And I'll explain how one gets that. And then the argument is, that then the procedure is, You stand at the origin, join it to the nearest points in your reciprocal lattice, and then bisect each one of them. And that then gives you the Brevan zone that you need. That's the overall procedure. But first point I want to explain is this concept of a reciprocal lattice. So the idea goes like this, that you see for any lattice, like in two dimensions here, you could define, as you know, two vectors, small a1 and small a2, such that any point on this lattice can be written as an integer times this plus an integer times that, that we have discussed. So any point on this lattice, wherever it may be, r, on, could be written in the form of n a1 plus m a2. Now, how do we construct the reciprocal lattice? The rule is that any point on that reciprocal lattice, I'll call that, say, capital K, that's any point on that reciprocal lattice, is given by some integer times a capital A1 and some integer times a capital A2, where these a, capital A1 and capital A2 have the following relationship with small a1 and small a2. The relationship goes like this. A1 is perpendicular to small a2 equal to 0. And that's equal to, so first rule is that this one is perpendicular to that and this one is perpendicular to that. And as you know, when two vectors are perpendicular, their dot product is 0. That's number one. And next thing is you normalize them such that if I dot this one with this one, I get 2 pi. And if I dot this one with this one, I get 2 pi. And in general, if you are doing this in three dimensions, I could have, it would work exactly the same way. You'd just have a capital A3 and a small a3 also. Three dimensions is exactly the same. Very good. Right here, P A3, for example, if you wanted. And then you'd have some P, capital A3, if you want. How do you get that? Let's see. Okay. Now, first thing is, then, for the square lattice, can you help me construct the reciprocal lattice? So first point is, for square lattice, what is small a1 and what is small a2? Remember, I'm trying to define them such that any point on that square lattice can be written as a linear combination of the two. You know, some integer times this plus some integer times that. And for the moment, we don't need to worry about this part. We'll get to that. So I would say you could write it as one of them is this vector and the other is that vector. Right? And then anything else is some integer times this plus some integer times that. That's easy enough. So I'd say you could write it as x, a, and a2 is y. So now, can you help me with what capital A1 and capital A2 should be? So when I'm writing capital A1, remember, what I'm trying to do is write something that's perpendicular to small a2. That should obviously be in the x direction, of course. And what should its magnitude be? Well, that's what this one tells me. It should be 2 pi over a. That's easy enough. And similarly, a2 is y 2 pi over b. Easy enough. Now, this is where it will get a little trickier when we try to do the graphene lattice, because it's got this hexagonal structure. It won't be quite so obvious. That we'll have to do this more formally. But here it's pretty clear. So you see, that's what this lattice is. You know, because how do I construct the reciprocal lattice? Well, capital A1 is in the x direction. This length is 2 pi over A. That's this vector. That's capital A1. That's capital A2. And then the reciprocal lattice is any integer times that plus any integer times that. That's it. And then the point is that if you want the Brillouin zone, this is what you have to do. But what you can show now is that if you give me any point here and another point here, which are whose difference is one of these reciprocal lattice vectors, then it will have the property that it will give you the same wave function for every point on the actual lattice. Let me just show that quickly. So the way it works is, supposing I'm trying to write the wave function at some point r on this lattice. And that is supposed to be proportional to e to the power I k dot r. And now someone comes along and says that to this k, I'm going to add some reciprocal lattice vector capital K. And what I claim is that it doesn't matter which point on my lattice I'm looking at, capital K dot R will be a multiple of 2 pi, and so it won't really matter. That's the argument. So what I'm going to prove is that capital K dot R, where R is a point on my actual lattice, and K is one of these reciprocal lattice vectors. You know, could be this, could be that, whatever it is. K is a reciprocal lattice vector, R is one of the real lattice vectors, and that multiple, no matter what I take, will always be a multiple of 2 pi. That dot product. That's what I'm going to show. Okay, so how do I find k dot r? You know, you got two terms here, so you'll have all kinds of dot products. But then remember, the way I've chosen it, this dot that is 0, this dot that is 0. So when I take the dot product of capital K dot small r, you know, this is a point on the real lattice, that's a point on the reciprocal lattice. And I take the dot product, it's basically just this dot this plus this dot that. Okay, and A1 dot A1, that's 2 pi. A2 dot A2, that's again 2 pi. So basically, when I take the dot product, I get 2 pi times small n times capital N plus small m times capital N, which of course is just a multiple of 2 pi. So what you can see easily is this is 2 pi times nn plus mm. And these being all integers, basically you are ending up with an integer multiple of 2 pi. So that's the bottom line, that anytime you have a point here, you can add a reciprocal lattice vector to it and it's still the same wave function. We have not found a new solution. And so if you tell me, okay, I have a solution corresponding to this k, I can always subtract a reciprocal lattice vector to bring you back in here and find an equivalent point in there. And so when I'm actually classifying solutions, I only need to consider this first Brillouin zone. Everything else can be mapped back to a point in there. Yeah.
This reciprocal lattice for us gives some information about the wave function. I mean, all of this case. So why this relation is there with 2 pi corresponds to this decay diagram? Why this definition gives this result? Why is it equal to 2 pi, not 4 pi?
No, I'd say that the way this is done, if I'm trying to show that a particular value of small k and small k with a capital K added to it, you know, this is the reciprocal lattice vector. I'm trying to show that this and this are basically the same solution because it will give you all identical values of psi. And because of the nature of this exponential, of course, that is true because this capital K dot R is always a multiple of 2 pi. Now, as far as 2 pi is concerned, of course, you could have defined things in such a way that you divide, let's say the capital K's were defined after dividing by a 2 pi, for example. That would be different. You could always have done things like that. So right now, I'd say that 2 pi is no more fundamental than what we had in that 1D example. You know, the 1D example where you easily see that anytime you add 2 pi over a to it, it's really the same solution. So this is just a 2D generalization of that same idea. Okay? Just 2D generalization of that. Nothing more to it, really. Yeah. Okay. So that's this 2D example. Now, this is an example, as I say, you could have done almost by common sense without bringing in the reciprocal lattice. What I want to show you next is this graphene example, where you really need to do it formally to get it right. Okay. So for graphene, you remember, the real space thing looks something like this. And the unit cell was defined as this. So if I want to think of the basic real space lattice, the important points are like this, 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 and always, and I'm not drawing these because this is the unit cell. So when I'm actually trying to think of the lattice itself, what it looks like, it's really just these points. Of course, I could have taken just these points. That would be fine too. But the point is, in every unit cell, you take a corresponding point. That's all. So the basic lattice then looks something like that. You know, everywhere, if you call this A and call this B, you are always keeping the A site and not the B site. So always the A sites. And so, as we had discussed before, on this lattice, you can write the location, write any point on that lattice as an integer multiple of a1 plus integer multiple of a2, where a1 and a2 are given by, can you help me? Remember, the vectors we had written down were this and this. When we are doing the EK relationship, if you remember, we wrote down, call this A1, call this A2. And then the idea was any unit cell can be obtained from this one by translating it by an integer times A1 plus an integer times A2. That was the idea. So A1 is, like it has a little bit of X and a little bit of Y. And I think we wrote the X component as A and the Y component as B. Right? And so A was like 3 halves the bond length, and this was like root 3 times the bond length over 2, etc. Okay. So here I'll just write XA plus YB. And A2 is equal to XA minus YB. And, you know, we have been considering this two-dimensional sheet. Now, actually in graphite, there are layers like this stacked on top of each other. Right? So if I had to write a A3, I could have written A3 is equal to ZC. Now, you might say, well, why are you writing A3? We have always been doing this in two dimensions. Now, this will be useful. You'll see in a minute why I am writing it. Right now, you know, this just comes out of the blue. You don't quite see why I'm writing it. You'll see that in a minute. Okay. Anyway, what I want to do though next is I have to figure out what is capital A1 and capital A2. So that I can construct the reciprocal lattice. So question is, can you help me with this? What's capital A1 and what's capital A2? So for capital A1, you see, I have to write something that is perpendicular to small a2. Actually, this is a three-dimensional thing. So actually, it should be perpendicular to both small a2 and small a3. And then its magnitude should be such that capital A1 dot small a1 is 2 pi. That's a separate thing. But first thing is, I need to write a vector that is perpendicular to both small a2 and small a3. How do you write that? Actually, there's an A3 also, and we could write that too. Right. So, and
A1 will be BX minus AY.
Right. So, you are, that would be one way to get a something perpendicular to this. Right? That's what you're saying. If you had to write something in the XY plane that's perpendicular to it, that's one way to do it. Now, the reason I brought in this A3 is that there's a very systematic way of writing it, which would actually work even if this were three-dimensional. And that is this. If you want to write something perpendicular to both A2 and A3, it must be A2 cross A3. You just have to take the cross product of the two vectors. You see? That's the point. So you could actually just write it as A2 cross A3. So the vector you said would come out automatically if we put A3 as z times something. And so when you take z cross this one, you'll get all the answers. So that's a very systematic way of writing it quickly. So that's why I kind of brought this in, you see? Okay. Now, the next thing is, of course, I have to adjust the magnitude. In a sense, it's A2 cross A3, but then I can multiply it by anything I want, and that's still perpendicular to A2 and A3. So how do I adjust the magnitude? Well, I want this dot product to be 2 pi. So the way you can ensure that is, if you put a 2 pi here, and then divide it by A1 dot A2 cross A3, that would do it. Why is that? Well, now if I take small A1 dot capital A1, what happens is, I get A1 dot A2 cross A3 in the numerator, which cancels the denominator, and I'm left with 2 pi done. That's it. So this is a systematic way, so that even if you got to very complicated lattices, you see, your A1, A2, A3s could have been in three dimensions, you could still use this to write down the reciprocal lattice vectors. Okay? It wouldn't take long. So, now, small a2, again, same story, 2 pi, a3 cross a1 divided by a2 dot a3 cross a1. And you could also write capital A3, except that we don't really need it. I just want to construct this reciprocal lattice in two dimensions. Don't really need it. Right? So I won't bother to write it. But you could write it using the same principle, nothing much. Okay, so how much does that come to then? What's capital A1? So A2 cross A3, which means I have to take this and cross it with Z. Then, as you know, x cross z is minus y, and y cross z is plus x. So you probably get something like, if you take a2 cross a3, you'd get minus x b and a, I guess y a, something like this. The minus sign isn't terribly important. You could, of course, take its positive sign as well in this context. And then you have to divide it by a1 dot that. So let me write it here so it will be clear. So it's 2 pi times minus xb plus ya, and there's a c multiplying it. And can you help me with what's in the denominator? Can you help me? The denominator is a1 dot this, which means whatever's up here, actually this is minus I think, right? So whatever's up here, and then I have to dot it with xa plus yb. No? Minus 2ab and a c also, which is why you can see, of course, the c doesn't matter. Now, whatever c was the unit vector in the z direction, but it just all cancels out anyway. So it doesn't really matter. So how much is that coming to? After taking the dot product, we got this. So the c cancels out, 2 cancels, and I think you get pi over a x and pi over b y. That's it. So it will be like x pi over a plus y pi over b. That's it. Similarly, if you do a2, you'll get, can you help me? 2 pi and then a3 cross a1. So now I'm doing a z cross this. So z cross x is y, so it's ya. So z cross y is minus x. And this is divided by a2 dot this. So I dot this with I think it's the same 2abc again, probably, no? Probably like abc. So, again, I think the 2 will cancel. So, we'll get x will have a pi over a. So, I think you get x pi over a minus y pi over b. Okay. Of course, once you have it, you can always check if you're right, just to make sure that, you know, a1 dot a2 is 0, a2 dot a1 is 0, this dot product is 2 pi, etc. You can easily check if your answer is right. Okay. But this gives you a systematic way of doing it for more complicated things. Okay. Okay. So using this, then, you can actually construct this reciprocal lattice for the graphene sheet. So you end up looking something like this. So I've got a kx and a ky. And the reciprocal lattice is constructed by taking, you know, these vectors and with multiples of that. So you've got a x pi over a plus pi over b. So that's one vector somewhere here, let's say. To get some more space out here. So, and then another vector somewhere here, another vector somewhere here. So this is like pi over a. This is like pi over b. And so a1 is that vector, a2 is that vector, and of course minus a2, that's also a reciprocal lattice vector, minus a1 is a reciprocal lattice vector. You could add the two, get something here. If you add these two vectors, you'll get that one, which would be like 2 pi over b, etc. and you could construct this lattice. You know, things like this. So this would be the reciprocal lattice. Now, once you have the reciprocal lattice, how do I get the Brillouin zone? Remember? You're kind of supposed to stand here, join it to various points. Okay. And then draw bisectors around each. Right? So you kind of bisect this one, bisect that one, etc. So every time you have a, you know, you first join this to all the nearest points and then you bisect them. Join it to wherever this is, bisect this one, bisect this one. And that is how you come up with this Brillouin zone. And then the idea is, you can give me a point anywhere here in this K space, and I can always find a reciprocal lattice vector so that you can subtract it and bring it inside this Brillouin zone. And so, when I'm cataloging my solutions, I only need to need values of K that lie in this Brillouin zone. That's it. And what you can show is, if you think about it, actually, that this is 2 pi over b. This point is actually 1/3 of that. So it's like 2 pi over 3b. And if you remember, that's also the point at which there was a minimum of this EK relationship when we were doing graphene. You know, I said there are special points which where the EK becomes 0. And those are the points that we are expanding things around. And so actually, you, if you look, these points are the points where you have those zeros. So when we expanded the EK relationship of graphene and came out with something that looked like this, if you remember, epsilon k is equal to plus minus square root kx square plus ky square, and multiplied by some constant. I don't know, whatever that constant is. But we came out with something like this. But that was a simplified relationship around this or around that, if you remember. So my question now becomes, yes, please. I think it's 6. I think it's. I think what happens is, like, so from here, yeah, very good point, by the way. So the rule is that you're standing here and joining it to all the nearest points and then drawing bisectors. Now, in this direction, the nearest point is here. So when I bisect it, I actually get a line out here. But since this is all, you already have this closed thing right here, that one has no impact on what happens. Whereas here, when I'm bisecting this one, that actually cuts this off. Because if I didn't have this, this would have gone on to that. So in that sense, it is not quite symmetric in how this works. Could have been if the A's and B's had been different. Right? Because A's and B's are not equal, that's why there's a difference, actually. Right? But that's a very good point. So you end up with this hexagon. And the thing is that those zeros are actually all around those points. So that brings us to this important question. That is, so how many valleys do you have in graphene? You know, for our discussion so far, I just said, well, you know, around those valleys, it looks like this, and go on from there. Get the density of stage modes, etc. But you also have to worry about how many valleys. And if you looked at this, you might have said 6 valleys. But that's not right. Why? Well, you see, you go to any one of these. Sure, there's a valley here, but then only 1/3 of it is within your Brillouin zone. The other 2/3 somewhere out there. So you really have 6 valleys, but each one is only 1/3 of a valley, because you should only consider this much. You should only consider that much, only that much. So effectively, it's really 2 valleys. Now, what is much more convenient, you know, rather than have 6 valleys and then try to figure out how to do this particular 1/3, What is much more convenient is to treat this as if you got one valley here and one valley there. Because remember, your Brevan zone is somewhat arbitrary in the sense that you don't have to be symmetric around this point necessarily. You could, as long as you don't double count any state, you're fine. So one way to say it would be, here you have a valley here, but all these states are really equivalent to the states here. So any k here is equivalent to a k there. Why? Because they are separated by a reciprocal lattice vector. So sure, I could do my bookkeeping by using k's here, but I could just as well, instead of using this, put them out here and do my bookkeeping around that. Similarly, instead of messing with this, I'm better off doing my bookkeeping over there. So instead of having a one-third valley here and a one-third valley here and a one-third valley here, I could just use one big valley there. And the same with these three. These three guys, instead of having a third of a valley three places, I could just put one big valley right here. And so finally in graphene, the thing is, what you really have and what you have to worry about is two valleys, one here and one there. This one looks like it's outside the Brevan zone, but what this really represents is this one. What I'm saying is that k and that k are equivalent because they are separated by a reciprocal lattice vector. And the important thing is you shouldn't double count. You shouldn't count this and that. But it is up to you whether you want to choose this one or that one. So just as in the 1D case, when you had EK relationship like this, you can go from here to here, or you can go from here to here. That's fine. As long as you keep the range right and you're not double counting, you're fine. The way you'd get in trouble is if you take everything all the way. Then you'd be counting many states a few too many times. Okay? So in graphene then, it's like we work around these two valleys, and that's it. There's two valleys. And this has very important consequences, you see. So, you know, as I always say, that when all this math often gets complicated and you wonder whether it has any connection with reality. And so it's always good every once in a while when you can actually connect it to something that someone can measure in a lab. And here again is one of those things you can. Why? Well, because, you see, if you had only one valley, then when you have a narrow sheet of graphene, the conductance, the ballistic conductance, would have been 2q square over h. Because remember, it's 2q square over h times this number of modes, 2 coming from the spin. And if you had one valley, then this minimum conductance would have been 2q square over h times m. And so m, the lowest one, would be equal to 1. But because there are two valleys, in graphene, when we actually go in and measure the ballistic conductance, the point is people get 4q square over h. The minimum conductance they get is not 12.9 kiloohms, but it's more like 6.3 kiloohms. And that's an experimentally measured fact, that ballistic conductance of graphene is more like 6 kiloohms rather than 12 kiloohms. And so this fact that you have two valleys and not six valleys and not one valley, that's a very directly observable thing that you can correlate with something that someone can measure in a lab. And that's, as I said, is always very reassuring. When you do this much of math, it's always very nice to see that it has, you know, connection to something very real that gives you the feeling that you're doing something right about all this. Okay? Let me stop here.